It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. It's Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. With me is 85%, always, is my co-host, Steven Brown. And we got most of the regulars in today. It has been a while since Dave Redfield is here, but he's here now.
Good morning, Caffeinated Comics. Or a good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
And Joe Pakovitz, comic book historian.
Hello, hello.
And Steven actually got us all Starbucks coffee for the first time in maybe a year.
Go, Steven.
Yeah.
Go,
Steven. Joe got me a gift card for Christmas. I lost it, and then I found it.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And here we are in February.
So St. Anthony got us.
Yeah. Hey.
Hey, there we go.
Hello. This is kicking it old school.
Don't get used to it, guys. I'm below the poverty line.
I always felt that was weird to have patron saints of things. It was like, it gets us very close to Greek gods.
You know what?
It was like, I'm the patron saint of finding shit.
During a confirmation, is that the one? You have to pick one of these saints to be your confirmation name. You guys are you familiar?
Yeah, this is the part when I called it quits on the Catholic.
Mine is Luke.
Oh, there you go. Mine is the I can't remember his name, but he is the patron saint.
You can't remember your own name.
Well, it's not my name. It's
it is, because you take a confirmation name, so you have four names now.
See, yeah, if you believe all
this shit.
I thought
that was bullshit. Because I was just like,
no,
I
you
don't
can put it on documents.
I don't have
can
a
you?
Middle name.
Does
they don't
do
stop
that?
You. Wow. They don't ask. Nobody asks you for it, but you can put it.
Does your confirmation name have to be religious, like off of the Bible?
It has to be.
They
a
give
saint.
You. A, they give you a list.
Yes, a
it doesn't have to be biblical, but it has to
makes
be a saint.
What makes it?
And it
a
has
saint.
To match your gender. So you can't be like Agnes or something.
Oh, can I be? Like, oh, since when?
The Pope says this guy's a saint. This guy's a saint now. So he has an approved list of
pretty
all.
Pretty much
saints.
Every name has got a saint somewhere.
But who makes the Pope the Pope? Like, why can't I start a religion?
The Black Smoke
my own?
Makes the Pope the Pope.
Yeah, they do that. They do that voting process.
It's the thing from Lost.
It's a whole thing.
Gets into the Vatican every now and then, and tells the Pope is. And then they eat fish biscuits.
So I got, by eighth grade, I'm pretty jaded with the Catholic Church. So I picked my patron saint I don't know what
saint
his name
jaded?
Is.
Saint Jaded?
Should have been.
It was a punk rock saint.
It's the patron saint against poisoning. And I thought, like, yeah, maybe I'll get superpowers out of this.
Well, there'll never be a time in your life where you're pro-poisoning.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So like,
I might fall out
least.
Of the church, but I'm never going to go onto the side of poisoning.
Right. So that's the patron saint.
Wait a minute, we are drinking coffee you just gave us. I'm feeling a little wizzy.
See, it's a good thing
that's
you
why
said.
I brought it up.
Someone's been watching Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to look up the patron saint against poisoning, now you know Steve's name.
It's like
name.
Batari or Bubba something.
Batari?
That sounds something like a character like from Babylon 5.
It sounds like a console system from the 80s.
You know what? Olden people had weird fucking names.
Can Steve Rogers people. Be a patron saint? I mean, like, he's been around for a while and he saved a bunch of people.
Seriously, how come they don't? They should do that story where they, like, the Pope nominates, like, a superhero for sainthood.
Can't Thor be
oh
a
my god, that would be
saint?
The end of the church right there.
We'll see,
it's
we'll
like,
see this.
It's
is
like, ah, nominate Saint Wolverine!
Yes.
The patron
why?
Saint of Logan's.
Right.
Because he's the best at what he does.
This is what,
and really, that's part of being a saint.
Yeah.
This is why I converted to Astaru.
Yes.
The Book of Oa.
All right. Now that none of
the, now that nonsense is out of
one the way. Comment got close to our topic.
What is our topic, John? I really don't know.
Recently, Brian Michael Bendis announced that he is leaving the X-Men titles, which once again ends an era of X-Men. And we've never had an episode where we really completely focused on X-Men.
Oh, so this is our X-Men podcast.
This is all X-Men. So I think Joe probably goes back the furthest. Joe, I know you collected John Byrne and Chris Claremont issues.
Right. I started with the whole Phoenix saga.
Ooh.
Dark Phoenix saga. That's when I jumped into comics.
So it's
in the
really
late 70s.
Kind of been all downhill from there.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like they could not have gotten better.
The curve from there to Mr. Sinister was
pretty steep.
And that's where I start. I start right at Secret Wars. So I start with John Romita Jr. into Silvestri, and I'm out before Jim Lee.
Okay.
So that's kind of my era. I know, Steven, you said you were introduced by the 92 animated series.
Actually, I was introduced by the 89 VHS of Pride of the X-Men.
Pride of the X-Men.
So, yeah.
How old were you in 89? Like,
No, I got this from Blockbuster probably sometime in the 90s.
But before the Fox show started, so
yeah, because I remember getting the Pride of the X-Men VHS and be like, oh, cool, they made an X-Men show.
But you knew who the X-Men were at that point?
Yeah, I probably had like a comic or something laying around, so I think I was aware of the X-Men, and then I got the VHS, and I'm like, oh, these are the X-Men, here's the Brotherhood, Juggernaut, and all these guys, and then when that 90s cartoon came out, I remember being disappointed, but for different reasons than you were, John, because Wolverine wasn't Australian. and I was disappointed by the shittier costume.
I was so disappointed by the overall quality of the X-Men animated series.
Yeah,
considering it was on at the same network and time as Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah,
and too. I guess what's, looking back on that cartoon, that was kind of like the big then, you know, introduced to like all these other characters that kind of come out of that. But that show...
It was a massive hit.
Oh, absolutely.
It beat Batman the Animated Series in the ratings consistently.
Yeah, and I think it was... It's definitely the biggest thing, you know, that has guided the X-Men since it came out. Like, that's kind of been, like, the big driving force. This is why Wolverine's a big deal and Gambit's a big deal because of that show. And, but it's something I, you know, I watched that show as a kid. I'm like, oh, that's sure, that was a decent show. And then, you know, you go back in your 20s and you watch it on Netflix and it's just like... Everyone is like every episode, just instead of just focusing on like Cyclops or Storm or Xavier, was like, here's an entire episode where Cyclops is just a massive bitch. Here's an episode where Storm is a massive bitch. Here's an episode where Charles Xavier is a massive bitch. It's like the whole show is just all the fucking characters just whining about how terrible
it is. Have you seen that supercut of Professor X whining?
Yeah, yeah.
I'll put that on the Facebook page. Somebody did a supercut of all the times like Professor X is attacked or whining, but he always had this high pitched.
Yeah.
It was like, he always was like, and he would do it like at the drop of a hat, it wouldn't build. He'd be like, let me see if I can.
Yeah.
And it would happen often. But Dave, I believe you're the only person in the room who is reading X-Men currently.
Yeah.
Which one are you reading right now?
I was. All new. Oh, man. All new. Yeah. Amazing. Sometimes uncanny.
Those are the ones I'm reading.
I was reading Wolverine.
Are you up to date, too,
Yeah, I'm up to date.
Yeah, I'm reading both of the Bendis monthlies, Uncanny and All.
I have not read an X-Men comic since Messiah Complex.
Oh, really?
Which I bought in a hardcover, and I have not read a monthly title since Whedon and Cassidy.
No, I hopped on the 90s cartoon was the big thing for me, to the point where I thought Wolverine was X-Man. Or I thought the title was like the,
it wasn't like, X-Men and it wasn't Wolverine.
But yeah. I thought, I was like, oh, the main guy is the X-Men or something like that. Because I was like, I don't know, 7 when it came out.
Yeah.
But I didn't even know his name was Wolverine until like the second or third episode. I was just like, the guy with the claws, that's what the show is named after. And these are his guys. Because obviously they just made it clear that Wolverine was like the coolest guy. But the first issue of X-Men I got into was when Wolverine lost his claws. I think it was at the funeral of Ileana. And Colossus, they buried someone, and Ileana just died to the legacy virus.
Oh, in Fatal Attractions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And maybe it was Colossus's funeral because then he injects.
No,
that
no it was Ileana's. Ileana died of the legacy virus, and that's how they found the cure.
Yeah.
And then, in that story, Colossus joins Magneto.
Yeah.
Doesn't Colossus inject the cure?
Yeah. Beast figures out the cure after all that nonsense.
But
and
they
then,
find out they have to inject it into a mutant.
And the mutant has to manifest its powers.
Right.
And then Colossus was like, I will sacrifice myself if it prevents other children like Ileana from dying from the virus.
That's what I remember.
And I picked up a few issues before then. And I just remember this, the cover of one of the issues was like Jubilee just crying and like Jean was there. And it was because like, it was right after Ileana died and she couldn't grasp at the concept that like a small child died because she was a mutant because someone just wanted to create a virus to eliminate them all.
Of course, she was a small child that was transformed into a teenager for about 20 years and then transformed back into a small child.
Then died and came back.
And hence died and came back. Who's alive now, I believe?
She's on the Uncanny.
She just got killed again.
Hey, Heroes Reborn. Do you want to talk about that nonsense for a while?
Well, that wasn't X-Men. They just used the X-Men crossover at the time to launch it.
Yes.
Much in the way DC did with Flashpoint.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But that was actually when I came back. I came back to X-Men right before the 92 series happened. So people were saying, oh, you got to read X-Men. And I missed Jim Lee completely. Like, I came back right when Image started.
Yeah.
And it was the Kuberts were like the big guys on there. And John Romita Jr. run. Had come back. And then Matt Arena was on it. And I stayed until pretty much after Age of Apocalypse, which was a great story. And then after that, it was kind of the decline for me. And I was like,
what happened
I can't
after
really come
Age
back.
Of Apocalypse?
Operation Zero Tolerance, which was really bad. That's so bad that I got the hardcover, read it, sold it to Steven, and it's still there.
It's at the it's on the shelf right now.
I was gonna I was actually gonna buy that the other day.
No,
there was a period.
Someday I'll flip through it.
There was a period in high school when the X-Men were just like Wolverine didn't have his metal claws. CC Monley or whatever, the Doctor Mutant. Was
oh, Cecilia Reyes.
Cecilia Reyes
and Maggot.
Maggot.
It was late 90s. And then they did this big Apocalypse the 12 that was supposed to be the big crossover to like settle all the plot lines from the 90s. And that made no sense.
Was that when Apocalypse, what's it called, was in charge of Cyclops? And he,
He turned Wolverine into one of the horsemen. It got really convoluted. And you know what? That's the bigger issue.
Just to let everyone know, like the X-Men, when written poorly, which is, I guess now that I think about it, 95% of the time that I've been reading it, it gets fucking batshit crazy.
Yeah, like it is the most convoluted of all the superhero families, especially once they started spinning it off and spinning it off. Back in the 70s and 80s, even when Chris Claremont was doing huge stories that weren't going anywhere, it was contained in one monthly. Once they started doing the New Mutants and then X-Factor and then Excalibur and then Wolverine got his solo title, it became impossible to keep up with anything.
Well, because it's an ensemble story, but it has no natural boundary. Like Fantastic Four, that has a boundary. First of all, it's the Fantastic Four.
There's only four.
There's only four in it, so you can't like go crazy and you know the Fantastic 68. But with X-Men, they kept inventing mutants and inventing characters, and every writer that went on there wanted to have their own mutants and add to the legacy.
Everybody wanted to add someone to the team.
Until finally they had to periodically cull them off. And then you get these great mass die-offs.
And the reason
they've
why
done like three or four of them with the mutants, they did the Massacre with Genosha.
Yeah, the mutant
massacre
is the first one
with House of M. It's like they kept doing it just to cut the ranks. And then, you know, I don't know if this is true, but we heard that that rumor that Marvel told Bendis, you know, don't create any more mutants because then Fox will get the right to them to make movies.
Right.
And we don't, you know.
Yeah, and the X-Men is the one thing Fox doesn't want to get rid of because that consistently makes money for them. Fantastic Four, not as much. You know, they gave back Daredevil.
Yeah.
But
I just love that the X-Men or just like mutants started because Stan Lee was like, I'm so tired of coming up with origins. How about he's just born with the powers?
Yeah. And
like,
they are the last major team that Stan created for the Marvel Universe.
And it's interesting, too, if you read any of the original, like first 25 issues of X-Men, they still explain. Like, they're like, all right, they're mutants.
Yeah, because they have a nuclear.
But like, like Xavier was, his parents worked at a nuclear facility, and Sunfire's parents were in Hiroshima when the atomic bomb got dropped, so they were still saying like, yes, they're mutants, but they have some connection to radiation.
Yeah, because he loved that radiation, boy. He loved radiation, and in Iron Man, he loved transistors.
Yeah.
Like, every issue of Iron Man, he's like, well, I can fly around the world now because I have transistors.
Yes.
Because I'm not running on vacuum tubes.
What was that reboot up movie of the X-Men?
First class.
Remember that the bad guy was like, we're going to set off atomic bombs so that
there'll be
more mutants.
Yeah.
So there's more mutants out in the world. I'm like, I don't know if that's going to work out so well.
Yeah.
But knock yourself out.
So when was the last time X-Men was your favorite book?
Astonishing X-Men.
Yeah.
Whedon and Cassidy.
I
was a big fan of Uncanny X-Force. That was one of my favorite X-Men books.
That's
a
good book, too.
See, for me, it's not so much about the book, it was about my age. I adored the book when I was about 13, because the book has always been about puberty, and it's always been about isolation, and they're, you know,
if you're gay.
Right, and they've done a great job of talking about minorities with it, or talking about homosexuality, which I think is a better analogy, and Bryan Singer did a great job with it, because with minorities, if you're born in a minority family, well, you're probably going to be a minority.
Yeah.
The thing with mutants is they're not always born to mutant parents.
Right.
And I think that analogy holds up well. But I found that I was super, super into it between the ages of like 12 and 16. And then once I'd moved on, partially because the book got so bad.
Yeah.
And it was at a time when DC was getting so good, so I kind of flipped from X-Men to Batman. I never quite saw it with the same eyes again. You know, I came back for Grant Morrison. I came back for Joss Whedon. I said I came back in the 90s post-Image. And there was a time with X-Men where it was all I was reading. I think in the mid-90s, this will probably make you mad, I think I was reading every X-Men book in Spawn, and that was it.
Jesus.
And I wasn't even reading Batman because Batman the Animated Series was putting on new episodes every day.
Yeah.
And I think Azrael was Batman. But there was a point where sounds I was like so super into it, but I never quite had, it never had the same impact on me as it did at that certain age. So I'm actually surprised that you guys are picking stuff that that came out later
in
your life.
Yeah, I guess I never had, when I would have been like a teenager, like the prime quote unquote age for like X-Men comics, they were awful. So, you know, well, I wasn't reading it. It was like, you know, like you said, it's like the entire time I was growing up, X-Men comics have been this huge like ball of yarn of like crossovers where it's like you have to read four or five different titles or it's tying in all these books. The art's not particularly good. The stories don't make any sense.
Wait, was so the art not good at that time, at your age at that time?
Wait, what year are you thinking of?
Yeah.
What year?
From like any time in the 90s up until...
Were you reading X-Men comics in the 90s though?
I was reading comics.
But avoiding X-Men.
But it'd be like, you know, you'd walk around the store and it'd be like, you know, I'd pick up whatever the newest issue on Candy was, flip through it, nah, this looks like shit, put it back on the shelf. Or they'd start like a new number one or a new jumping on point like in the 2000s. And it'd be like,
yeah, because in the 2000s you get Grant Morrison, so you figured...
And, that's what I'm saying.
And you had, and you had like Ethan Van Sciver and Phil Ramirez. You had, you had great artists and a great writer in 2000.
I tried New X-Men when it first came out and hated it, because I hated Quiet Lee's art. And it wasn't until they did All-Star Superman that I was like, wow, this guy really knows his stuff, and went back. And it wasn't that he really knew his stuff. He knew his shit on X-Men. But I hadn't figured it out
yet. We weren't educated.
Well, Quiet Lee's kind of like Kirby, where you can get so caught up on the weird way he draws faces that you're missing what he's doing with storytelling
and
that's so incredible.
What probably would have helped was just see a picture of what Frank Quietly looks like, because he draws like he looks. He looks like a weird-looking dude.
He's just looking in the mirror and scrunching his face up.
I think he's like anyone who draws, I think. Everyone kind of, you can see it's like they kind of look like you. And I think that's what he kind of like. His guys kind of look like him. His Cyclops looked a lot like him. His Superman looked like a heavier version of him. But yeah, I just remember hating his art, and then I hated Van Sciver's art.
I still do.
I liked his Rebirth, and that was it. His Green Lantern Rebirth. Everything else that guy's done has been awful.
Yeah, for
but me. So New X-Men, when it came out, I was just like not into it. And then it wasn't until Astonishing where I got into an X-Men monthly. And like that was like my first monthly X-Men book was probably Astonishing.
Yeah, for me, it wasn't the art so much as the writers. No. I started in the, again, with the Dark Phoenix saga and kind of from there worked my way backwards. So you're dealing with like Cockrum.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So it's not great. It's not horrible, but it's not great.
Yeah.
But it was about the writing because, you know, like John, I was about 12, 13 when I got into it. And it was kind of like an acceptable soap opera for teenage boys because there were characters my age. You know, I couldn't relate to the Fantastic Four. I couldn't relate to a Reed Richards.
Yeah, they're settled.
I couldn't relate to a Captain America. I couldn't relate to an Iron Man. But I could relate to Kitty Pride.
Yeah.
I could relate to, you know, some of
the
X-Men.
You could relate to Spider-Man.
They're in high school, so they were maybe just a little bit older than I was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Spider-Man's a great analogy because Spider-Man in the Silver Age was also kind of that same teenager, felt like an outcast, felt like... misunderstood and was a great role model for teens. But by the time Joe and I started reading Spider-Man, or by the time you guys were reading Spider-Man before Ultimate, he's settled.
Yeah.
He's accepted the fact that he's Spider-Man. He's an adult. He looks kind of cool. Like he's got hot girls around.
Yep.
You know, he's less of an outsider. But the X-Men always remained outsiders. And when they moved from being a bunch of teens, like Teen Titans, where is how it started, really, it became more of a political issue, which kept it going.
Right, because you always had the Sentinels there. You had the you know, a lot of that stuff that came out of the 60s that they were trying to go into, you know, persecuted minorities and things like that. So, that part of it was also interesting, too, because when you are a teenager, you are starting to look at the outside world a bit more, and you are starting to learn about things like politics and how the world works.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something. What's one of your favorite X-Men stories?
I just reread Dark Phoenix Saga, so
it's hard to argue with Dark Phoenix.
It really is. That's what I was kind of saying to Joe earlier.
It's like arguing against Dark Knight Returns when you're talking about Batman stories. It's such a gold standard.
Yeah. I just think like,
and it's totally earned its place. It's entertaining when you read it. It's not dated. It's not it's not one of those stories where you read and you go, oh well, this was important because nobody was doing this yet. It's
it holds up. Really great. It holds up.
There's I got so many favorite X-Men stories and they're so different. I remember there was I don't know if you remember this, Joe. Remember District M? When Bishop was a cop in M-Town?
I was out by Bishop
getting there. That's during the Grant Morrison run, right?
Yeah, I think so. I remember where it was just like, okay, this is the slums. These are the less popular mutants, the people that just look weird and no one wants to associate Morlocks. With.
They basically, District M, correct me if I'm wrong, this was like, you know, they were still trying to figure out what to do with the X-Men. And it was, all right, you know, so we've got like Queens, you've got the Bronx, you've got Brooklyn, you've got, you know, Hell's Kitchen, Clinton or whatever they're calling it, all these different places. And the District M was supposed to be like the mutant town in New York City, where it was like the entire neighborhood. This is where mutants went, right? You have Chinatown, you know, in every major city, they've got a Chinatown. This was like the
Little Italy.
Town. Little Italy, right? The village. And they had that for a long time. And that was actually, you know, another run we haven't really talked about is Peter David's X-Factor run.
Yeah.
Was set in there. Madrox opens up a detective agency in Mutant Town. And they were just taking mutant cases when that book started. So it's like he was a detective to the mutants and like, oh, my, you know, husband's a mutant and, you know, he got murdered by, you know, this guy or whatever. And then they'd go and like solve the case because like regular cops like wouldn't help out the mutant population.
Yeah. And it's just like there's so many great stories when you use mutants right, where it's just like they don't always have to rob a bank. They don't always have to take over the world or kill human race. It's just like, what was that in that Spider-Man, the Marvel Knights Spider-Man, when one guy goes into a brothel and he just happens, and it's like all shapeshifters.
Yeah.
And it's just like, who do you want to sleep with today, buddy? It's
Invisible.
Yep. It's just like, it's so nice when people just use little things like that, little nuggets of like mutant powers and like those types of storytelling. And District M, like tons of times it would just be like stories where you're just like, Bishops or X-Factor trying to figure out like who's killing all these people, and then you find out like the mutant can clone himself and he's just killing like himself and other people at the same time. And it's like so crazy things that you never really like whatever think about, because every time people think about X-Men and mutants, they're always just like, this guy shoots this power and that guy shoots this power and the other guy shoots both of those powers and makes a shield. And it's just like they always create characters to like just fight each other, where it's just like they don't create characters for like a story purpose anymore.
I would disagree with that. I would say that it took them a while to figure out that X-Men was not a title that's conforms to your typical superhero pattern where he fights crime. That eventually became less of a focus for the X-Men when the writers started figuring out this book is not about these guys going out and fighting crime. It's about these guys going out and trying to exist in a society that hates them.
Yeah,
and it's just like in Grant Morrison's run, like he took a group of mutants that don't, like, you're just like, these are the most useless mutants in the world. And it's just like, yeah, but they're mutants. And we're going to show you how the Xavier Skull deals with them. And like NYX. NYX was a story that like Quesada started. And it's just basically like the pitch line for it was like, what happens to mutants that don't get found by Xavier? And it just tells you like this tragic story of just like one girl figures out that she could stop time. And she starts noticing things around her. She just finds out how horrible life is for other people. Because it's just like, you know, when you have no one to guide you and you're a mutant and you know, you have all these things happening to you and you can't talk to anyone about it. Like, there are people out there that will take advantage of you. Some of them might be Professor Xavier, but other people might be like drug dealers and like cartel and stuff like that.
Well, the whole New Mutants storyline was pretty much about that, because their big villain was the White Queen.
Yeah.
And she had her own academy. It's like the anti-Xavier.
Yeah, the Hellfire Academy.
The Hellfire thing.
So it's like when stuff like that is being dealt with in like the X-Men world, I think those stories are just amazing. Like, those are some of my favorite stories. Like, as much as I like, you know, good guys and bad guys fighting, but man, do I love it when writers take, you know, X-Men stories, even if it's just going to be like one or two issues or a small story arc, and just twist them, where it's just like no powers are being used, just the abusive of like the human nature is what we're going for. But like, you know, you love that. Like, those are some of my favorite X-Men stories.
Yeah.
But you guys love the Dark Phoenix saga. I think without a doubt, it's one of the best stories out there. But remember when Ed Brubaker took the X-Men and went out to space again with the Shi'ar Empire?
I never read that. I always wanted to pick up that hardcover, The Rise and Fall of the Shi'ar Empire.
The Rise and the Fall of the Shi'ar Empire?
I didn't like that, because We'd been, well, number one, I hated those guys. Number two,
the Shi'ar guys or the Star Jammers.
The Star Jammers. Then he became Cyclops' father.
The Imperial Guard.
Like, screw that noise.
I had a hard time with the X-Men in space myself. I felt like it was kind of outside what made that book work.
Well, we'd also been there before. Roy Thomas had already mined that pretty much in the mid-70s.
And Claremont with Cochran.
Right.
I think once you got to the brood, that was enough space.
Right. And you're like, okay, done. These guys back to Earth where they belong, where they can be persecuted again and have to live in their society.
I think that's the trick is, you know, like we were saying, the X-Men as like this political book works really well. But there's such a history with them, with the Shi'ar out in space.
I mean,
the
that's the Dark
the
Phoenix.
Crap.
It's like they pick.
There's a lot of
Jean
space
Grey.
In Dark Phoenix.
Yeah. And I think it's a lot of people, anyone like Brubaker or Fraction or whoever was writing these big space stories for the X-Men, definitely grew up on that Dark Phoenix saga and were trying to recreate that. This is why every new writer, I mean, there's probably been 8 or 9 people going back to try to do Phoenix stories.
Yeah.
You know, AVX was about the whole thing. We're just like people.
Yeah, but you can't take that story out of its time period too, because the two grand space sagas that everybody goes back to are Kree versus Skrulls.
Yeah.
And Dark Phoenix.
Yep.
Maybe Korvac saga. Maybe that's usually the distant.
Has
bird.
Anybody touched
Great Darkness
Korvac?
Saga?
Yeah.
The Legion of Superheroes with Darkseid. Yeah.
I'm talking Marvel.
And you know, like Galactus too, you know, it's the same thing. You know, the first couple Galactus stories are great. John Byrne did a great Galactus story. A lot of people try
that
to
original
do it.
Stan Lee Kirby is a classic.
Yeah. But the more you revisit it, the less it chips away at it.
Right.
It doesn't,
how often can this guy try to eat the Earth and fail?
Right, yeah.
Before
no
he
other
becomes
Earth,
a loser.
If no other Earth can, you know, or no other planet, you know, can stop him.
Right. That's why there was a great, when Byrne was on Fantastic Four, the best Galactus story I ever saw was when he ate the Skrull homeworld.
Yeah.
Which screwed up the Skrulls for like 5 years.
Right. Longer than that.
But they showed that like he really was unstoppable.
Yeah. And I think there was a story, it's in one of the X-Men books. Maybe it is the first time the Shi'ar come to Earth. I can't remember exactly, but it's something like, you know, the Shi'ar ship or one of their scout ships is like flying past Earth. And they do a quick read on the planet, and they're like, we got to get out of here. You know, we have to get as far away from this planet as possible. Like, why? It's like, this is that planet that fought off Galactus. And they just fucking make a U-turn and just jet off into deep space. Because if something like that happened, you know, in the intergalactic, like, space community, that shit would spread like wildfire, right? Because mm-hmm. everyone kind of hears whispers of Galactus out in space. Everyone's kind of aware that this thing is out there. And then rumors would kind of start, no, this planet that, like, hasn't even, like, explored their own solar system fought off Galactus. And then it, like, inspires, like, all this, like, resistance across
the
galaxy.
Doctor Who plays with that a lot.
Yeah.
Like a lot of aliens are afraid of Earth because the Doctor always shows up there.
Yes, and I think stuff like that is a great way to do, you know, and they've kind of touched on that before. You know, Marvel's done a good job, I think, of building up a good range of like space empires. There's a lot in Marvel, and DC's got a lot too, but it doesn't seem like, besides like Darkseid and the New Gods, it's like no one really gives a shit about the Thanagarians.
Yeah, and Marvel's space, I feel like it's more shared. Like, I feel like at any moment any one of your comic book stories could deal with something from space. Like,
right.
Like the Fantastic Four have the Skrulls and Galactus. The Avengers had the Kree and Skrulls war.
Yeah.
And the X-Men had Shi'ar.
The Shi'ar and the Kree went to war in the 90s during Operation whatever the fuck
it
was called.
And then
Galactic Storm or whatever it was called.
And the Guardians of the Galaxy have the Spartax Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Brood was in Planet Hulk.
You know, Infinity
did. And the Brood came into the X-Men.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what, like, I think Marvel's...
They took the idea of basically the shared universe of, hey, all these superheroes live in New York instead of like Gotham City and Fawcett City and all this shit, and was like expanded that to space. So it's like, look, these alien races, there's like 8 or 9 big races out in space that have huge empires. These guys are constantly going to war. They're tripping over each other. They have long histories. Like, all that stuff interferes. You never really hear like, oh, the Thanagarians. It's one planet.
Yeah.
The Green Lantern Corps. It's only in like part of space.
And they're
Darkseid.
They're supposed to like protect all the sectors.
Yeah.
And you only hear, it's like, where's the sector where like where Darkseid runs it.
They just say right. Like, it's outside.
I remember back in the 90s when we were trying to pitch the stuff to Marvel and DC, the first thing we thought of was actually, I did this with Jason Rafalis, who did a bunch of DC work. We pitched Darkseid versus Parallax because Hal Jordan was Parallax at the time. We're like, why doesn't the Green Lantern Corps do anything about Apocalypse?
You know what?
They're supposed to govern the entire universe.
Are you talking about that, the Nail story where like the Guardians make this peace offering with Darkseid where it's like, we won't interfere in your sector?
Yeah, there's some kind of Green Lantern story. It's like a one shot, and Dave's. This is exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, it's I think it was in the Kyle Rayner run. He finds like an old story. Somebody tells him a story about like an old Green Lantern. And they did. They dispatch a Green Lantern to Apocalypse to be like, all right, look, this place is just like a hellhole. We're finally getting around to the edge of the rim over there. Go take care of it. And this dude just gets annihilated by Darkseid and gets like captured and then forms like a resistance. And then like the Green Lanterns and Darkseid, there was some kind of like pact they made where they were like, all right, we're going to take care of the sector space, but like we have a hands-off policy with this planet because this guy is like, it's just like the North Koreans, right? It's just like, do whatever you want. Just don't fuck with too many other people. You want to know why
the Green Lanterns don't mess with Darkseid?
Why is that?
Because of Superman.
Because of Superman.
Superman would be angry. He's like, hey, you're taking on my bad guy.
That's my guy.
I got nothing else to do, guys.
But you know what? I'll just talk about the big space operas, and we pointed to Dark Phoenix Saga. It actually, the more I thought about when... Dave, when you asked what my favorite story was, I realized my favorite story was one of those smaller character ones. I think it's 183. It's right after Secret Wars when Colossus and Kitty Pryde break up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then he fights.
They fight in the bar.
Logan takes him to the bar.
Yep. He cheats on her with some girl in the Secret Wars that Jim Shooter just threw in. And then Chris Claremont was like, well, that breaks these two up. And they have this really real scene where they're like sitting on a cliff. And John Romita Jr. is a young artist at the time, but he gets the emotions down. And then Wolverine and Nightcrawler take him out to a bar. And he's like 19. He's underage. But they're like, we're going to take you out.
I love that.
He has to deal with it. And
my favorite thing about that story, sorry for interrupting, it's like Wolverine and Nightcrawler. So it's like Colossus at the tender age of 19 goes to a bar, and it's just like you got the devil, which is Wolverine, and you got Nightcrawler, who's like the angel. It's just like, come on,
the angel who looks like the devil.
Yeah. Come on, Ruski, take another shot
actually,
of vodka.
I was reading the Paul Smith run, because they just put it out of Marvel Masterworks, like the whole From the Ashes and Around the Wolverine Limited series. I forgot how much they teamed up Wolverine and Nightcrawler.
They were a great team,
and they even did it with the Nightcrawler Returns. They had a lot of nice moments between Wolverine and Nightcrawler. But that reminds me, remember God Loves, Man Kills? That's another awesome story. That's in that Masterworks.
Yeah. And I read that again, and I forgot how much they used for X-Men 2.
Oh, yeah.
Because I forgot, it had been years since I read it, but I forgot that Stryker actually was in the military, and he did have a mutant son, and he uses Xavier to try to kill all the mutants. So I thought they had just taken the Stryker character from God Loves, Man Kills, but reading again, there's a lot more they pull out of it. But my point about that issue was all about character, and there was a big fight in it because Juggernaut happens to be in the same bar, and Colossus and Juggernaut have a fight, and like Nightcrawler goes in, and Wolverine's like, nah, it's his fight, and they tear the whole bar down. There's this one panel I just loved. Is that
where Wolverine's on the bar, and he points his claws, and Juggernaut's like eye-to-eye level with him?
No, that is a good one, but my favorite is when Juggernaut picks up the bar.
The entire bar.
The entire bar slams it on Colossus, and you see his arms sticking through.
Yep.
Like, it doesn't even bend his arms. They just tear through, and I think that was the moment reading comics where I really realized what a comic artist could do, which is probably why I'm a John Romita Jr. fan to this day.
Yeah.
But that whole issue was about characters really responding. It was all about Colossus's guilt and having to fight through that guilt, and it was all about him doing something wrong and having to pay penance for it.
Right, and it's about Wolverine making sure that he does pay penance for him, because that's why Wolverine's like, tell Nightcrawler, no, let Colossus get his ass kicked.
Yeah, because Wolverine has this strict code of honor.
Right,
which
he's like, Colossus screwed Kitty over and betrayed her. We're going to betray him when he counts on us to fight Juggernaut.
Yeah, and so he sees how it feels. There's a lot of levels in that really simple story. And as much as I have a hard time with Claremont now because he's so flowery and he gets sidetracked. And, you have one panel of the mansion where today they would say, Xavier Mansion. And there's a big paragraph of like, a bird lands on a tree and tweets this morning, and then he will build a nest. And you're like, this doesn't help at all.
Well, he was always the most verbose of the writers, even in his heyday.
Yeah.
But you would get, kind of like Johnson, you would get that either that one issue, like the Caliban, Kitty Pryde marries Caliban, or
that's my first issue,
or even two or three pages within an issue where the characterization just lands so right that you're just like, okay, this is what comics writing should be.
Yeah, you really felt like you were living with these people every month. And he would always have a scene of just somebody in their room, like Storm is watering her plants and thinking about what's going on. And it wasn't plot, plot, plot. And I think that's the thing that's the hardest to nail because at its heyday, there's none of that. You know, as you were saying, Dave, it's like, it's not about I have the superpower and I fight this other guy with the superpower. In the 90s, it kind of was that. It was like every issue, they're not in the mansion at all. They're always in the war room and the danger room where somebody could just draw straight lines. And they lived in this world of metal. They're always in their costumes. They're always flexing. And they're like, there's that mutant that hates us. And then they would all leap and scream for 20 pages.
They were just on steroids at that point.
Yeah. And that's what most people think of X-Men, which is 180 degrees for what I really loved about that book, and maybe that's a reason I could never quite connect with it again.
Well, they're starting to get back to that place. I mean, when I jumped in back in, I hadn't been in since the introduction of Mr. Sinister. That's what finally said, don't fuck this. I only got back in after Chimera's opened. Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome. Thank you, Joe.
I jumped in at that point. I tried to go backwards.
Yeah.
I didn't get very far. I got you to Astonishing, and then I said, oh, the rest of this stuff sucks. But going forward from that point, they're really trying to get back to care. I think they finally figured out again, hey, this is character driven. And I mean, some of it is pretty stupid. Like a lot of this time travel stuff now is getting to be a bit old.
Yeah.
But they're going back to, you know, here's Xavier School, and the kids are now starting to learn. And here's some scenes of them learning this stuff, like the Wolverine and the X-Men, that short-lived spinoff was really, really good for that, because it really introduced you to a lot of these younger mutant characters. But it also gives those of us who have been around for a while and have seen, like, the introduction of Kitty Pryde, for example. Now she's a headmistress. To go back to John's point, you do feel like you're growing up with these people because now they're entering their adulthoods and the focus has changed. It's like kind of when The Simpsons started focusing on Homer instead of Bart.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's really great. And this is the part that I loved about the old pre-52 DC. It's just legacy. The fact that, like, these people were students and now they're teachers. Like, I love that. And what stinks is, like, if there's ever a character you're just like, if you were a writer and you're just like, oh, I can't write Cyclops and I can't write Storm and I can't write any of the original X-Men, you know what? Why don't I do an X-Men book where we focus on the small kids? And then eventually, like, down the road, like, I'll work with characters already pre-exist, and I'll make those characters people I could write, and they could go on their own adventures. Like, after House of M, they did another shakeup in the X-Men titles, and they finally took Wolverine off each title, because before House of M, Wolverine was like an uncanny X-Men and Astonishing X-Men
and the Avengers
and Wolverine, like all these books. And then after House of M, it's just like, all right, replace Wolverine and just put Wolverine like characters. Like they put X-23 and new X-Men and what was it, Warpath, or was it Thunderbird?
Warpath.
Yeah. So they put Warpath on Uncanny X-Men. They put Wolverine on just regular X-Men and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, like, the books started gelling again, because there was only one character in each team, and these teams went out in their different path, like, on their own way. Like, X-Men will eventually go out to space or deal with New York, and then another one, Uncanny X-Men, would be like, well, we're in Europe and we're tracking down this mutant. And then new X-Men would be like, well, we're at the school and we're just trying to survive.
Well, the Avengers are going that route too, with different sub-teams. They're breaking up into different sub-teams and things like that.
And it makes it great, because you get a chance for other characters to shine. And that's the thing that really, it works in the X-Men department, because there's so many characters that when you break the team up and you let these people shine, it's great. And it gives you different villains to fight. Like, for example, like Dark Phoenix, like, we went in space. The X-Men were fighting aliens. That's awesome. And then Juggernaut's not mutant. He's a magic villain.
We watched that original episode. I got season one of the 90s show. Yeah. And they even make a point in that episode, and I didn't even know why, where Juggernaut's fighting him, and he's like, I'm not a mutant. I'm made out of magic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why?
My powers are magical.
Why do you say that?
Because Juggernaut's a racist.
But there's always that point with Juggernaut, even though he's just like the stepbrother of Professor X, he's like, I'm not one of you guys.
Yeah.
But just wants, like, to make it clear.
Like, you know, like Dave was saying, to his point, you know, they've got enough characters. This is why a book like Excalibur works so well, where it's like, all right, we're going to take a group of X-Men, send them over to Europe, where in the Marvel universe, it's actually kind of cool that they do this, and it kind of reflects some of like the European type ideas. Like, we're really hung up here in America with like nudity and sex and all this stuff. Like, we're really kind of like prudish about it. You go to Europe and it's like there's nude shit everywhere, and it's awesome. And I think in the comics, they kind of reflect that, where it's like, you know, mutants go to Europe and there isn't this crazy prejudice against them in Europe. Like, you know, they can be on Britain's premier super team, Excalibur, with Captain Britain. You know, it's the Excalibur is doing what the X-Men Avengers Unity Squad was doing, where like, hey, let's put Captain America, Rogue, and Wolverine on the same team. And you have these mutants stand next to the Avengers and it'll help their cause. Well, in Excalibur, it's like, nah, we're doing that already. Captain Britain's the most popular superhero in Europe. He's, you know, this huge, like, shining example of, like, what a hero's supposed to be. And here's Nightcrawler and Colossus, you know, are on the same team with them. And it, you know, it's they kind of work in the same way where Batman works. Where we've talked before, like, Batman works. You know, you put Batman in space, it works. You put Batman in time travel, it works. You put Batman fighting crime, it works. He fights superheroes, it works. He fights the Justice League or teams up with the Justice League. It all kind of works. And the X-Men does the same. Look, they've done Days of Future Past where they go to the future. They've done Savage Land stories where they're kind of in, like, prehistoric times. They've done the space stories. They've done the street
the
stories.
The alternate realities.
Yeah,
alternate
Exiles. Realities.
Exiles.
Yeah. And you know, can also change the tone of a book, too. Excalibur was a fantastic example. That when everybody else was all dark and heavy, Excalibur was light. Yeah. It was like the best, the Demata Skiffin run of JLA.
Or look at Deadpool.
Or I Deadpool. Mean,
Deadpool
yeah.
at this point is not really considered an X-Men character.
Yeah.
I still think he is just because Fox is making a Deadpool movie.
Yeah, I mean, but, he's an X-Men
but
character.
Deadpool was
but...
so far outside yeah. what they were doing that he was just accepted by the overall Marvel Universe as his own thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, and it's like, it's a great thing. It's just like, so we talk all this great stuff about the X-Men, how they work. Then Bendis came in.
Yeah, now I haven't read any of All New X-Men. I haven't read any Bendis since he left Avengers. Now, Joe, Dave, you've read his whole run?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Steven?
Yeah, I've read the whole thing.
So I'm the only one that hasn't read it. What is your review now that it is ending?
Where the fuck is his editors?
Well,
typical Bendis. Starts off strong, great premise, peters out into nothingness.
Yeah, it's, I can't, you know, with his Avengers run, which is like his, when he really hit a stride, those first 5 years on New Avengers, I can point to 3 or 4 or 5 really solid story arcs. Like, this was a good story, this was a good story, this is a good story. They're on what issue of Uncanny now? 28 yeah. or 27, yeah. something like this. I couldn't tell you one, I know one story that happened. It was, a future X-Men team came back from the future, and then it turned out they were really the future Brotherhood of Mutants.
And it turns out that, like, they weren't all really evil, just the Xavier child, love child between Xavier and Mystique,
and then
the love
child. Mystique's kid.
Yeah, and the whole time travel thing with the original X-Men. I mean, I like the all-new X-Men book when it first launched. It was like, okay, fine, we can get the original X-Men back, you know, send them, you know, back in time or forward in time, whatever the hell they were doing. And it was a great premise because you get the contrast between the adolescent naivete of then with the grown-up cynicism and world weariness of now. And that was great.
And
but now it's gotten out of control.
It is. And it's something where I get the premise where they're like, we'll bring the original 5 X-Men back. And when we talked before on the show how frustrating that was, because it was like the first 6 or 8 months of that was them just running into every superhero in the Marvel Universe.
They were doing
like,
a tour across the
yes.
U.S.
And it's just like, hey, you need to go back to the past. You're right, we do, but next issue we're meeting Havoc.
Yeah.
And then they go meet Havoc, and Havoc's like, you guys need to go back to the past. They're like, yeah, sure thing, Havoc, but we're going to meet Spider-Man next. And it's like, it was really frustrating.
We haven't met everybody in
exactly.
the Marvel Universe.
And it was frustrating because Bendis didn't even have his timeline correct for that book.
No.
Because they'd be like, oh, here's the original 5 X-Men, and then they meet like a modern day Sentinel, and they're like, what the hell is that? The Sentinels show up in like the 6th or 11th issue of the original X-Men.
They're Jack Kirby.
They're Jack Kirby. So it's like, in the first year, they fought Sentinels. If these X-Men don't even know who Sentinels are, they've been X-Men for like 6 weeks. So it's like, they were...
Well, they were in the yellow and black costumes, so they were
right.
at least early in their run.
They were really early, yeah.
But
they weren't that Neil Adams run.
It was something where it was just like, you know, good present, you know, what do you call it? Premise, but just really fell off apart. And what worked really well, and me and Dave talked about this, was... You know, they took that original 5-member X-Men, and then they said, all right, let's put him in a room with X-23, who's like a teenage Wolverine. Awesome. Let's put him in a room with Ultimate Spider-Man, Miles Morales, who's a teenager. It's like, that team, I think, had so much potential for, like, you know, those X-Men to team up with that Spider-Man as a monthly book. That's awesome.
I would have put them, like, if they were so into this, like, I'm not tied into any universe, I would have been like, this is the weird X-Men that goes out and does the weird storylines. This is the X-Men that has a character, characters from the past, character from current, and character from an alternate universe.
Yeah.
And it's like, go out and do the weird stories and just, like, stay away from the Marvel U.
Well, yeah, they, like, they tried to incorporate it too closely into the whole... Cyclops leads this mutant rebellion, and he's now bad.
Oh, that's what's coming.
They,
oh,
they,
just that.
That was a great Phoenix starting. Story, that was ABS. A great starting off point,
yes,
for all new X-Men. But then they just kept at it. It's like, no, no, get away from that storyline.
Yeah, I think the original couple issues of that Uncanny X-Men run were great. They put Cyclops in this radically different uniform, which is actually kind of cool.
I hate that uniform.
You don't like that
because he doesn't have his visor
across his face. Yeah, the visor is what makes him iconic. And yeah, I'm fine.
He needs the visor.
And I'm fine when he has, like, the skull cap, or when he had his hair out when Jim Lee did it.
Yeah.
Or even X Factor, which I thought was ugly, when he had the big X going across his body, or the yellow where it yellow started one, out.
Yeah. Even if he has glasses where he just raises them to shoot and then lowers them, it's just like he had such a problem controlling his powers. Now he has this, like, how does he
that
see
that comes out of his nose? It's like what's the fuse in a one beam? I just think it's ugly. And it ruins the one thing that makes him look like Cyclops. It's like if you redesigned Batman's costume and he still had the utility bait, he still had the cape, but he didn't have any ears.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, the ears were getting in my way. He just wouldn't be that icon anymore.
Yeah. Right. And I think it's something where, you know, they kind of... Another example on Uncanny X-Men, what it started with Bendis, was here's a book that has a lot of potential, and he just could not figure out what to do with it. You know, right. Cyclops was going to be this, like, radical revolutionary that was going to run around, like, you know, abducting mutants from, you know, harm and shit like this and do all this really cool stuff. And then it just turned into, all right, well, Bendis clearly really wants to write, like, a Maria Hill book because she's in every episode of Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah, it's like he's trying, like, to audition for the Avengers movies.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, I think why, you know, they said, oh, he's going to end, he's going to leave his run. It's just like, thank God, maybe we'll get an X-Men book I can read monthly and enjoy.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know what it is about Cyclops, but it seems like he's the character that people get so wrong so often. Like, it's Wolverine, everybody got Wolverine, but Cyclops has been a villain several times because he was written so unsympathetic.
It's the best Marvel version of Superman.
Yeah, the best Cyclops I ever read has to be Joss Whedon.
Like, yeah,
I think Claremont and Whedon.
Claremont really
it.
Got him. As I said, I was just reading the Paul Smith run where he first meets Madeline Pryor, and yeah, that storyline goes right in the toilet. But those first few issues where he meets her and she looks like Jean Grey and he's trying to get past it, he's a really well-rounded character, and he was my favorite at that point. And there have been periods of the X-Men where it's like, I'm liking this guy for nostalgia reasons. It's like meeting someone. It's like becoming Facebook friends with somebody you went to high school with and you realize they're a jerk.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, but I liked him 10 years ago, so I guess I like him now. That's how I feel about Cyclops half the time.
But what makes him interesting is he's on this knife edge between hero and villain. And he can go either way, but it's really, really hard to keep the balance of that tension. That's why so many writers fuck it up.
Yeah. Well, he's all about repression. And I feel like a lot of writers don't know how to do that, especially in a visual medium where everybody's leaping and screaming.
Yeah.
You have this guy, he's all about control, which is why he's the leader, because his whole life was, here's this one thing you can't control that will destroy everything around you if you don't figure out some kind of control. And he can't figure it out, so he has to put this thing on his face just to keep himself protected at all times. So that's how he approaches all of life. Like, how do I protect these? How do I protect these people from getting hurt? How do I control this? How do I keep this moving forward? And there's so many people have taken that to be, he's an asshole to the rest of the team.
Yeah. Right, and then that's why Whedon just totally freaking nailed it when Emma Frost deconstructs his psychology.
And
just
goes like, why are you the leader?
I was
you clearly
can't.
Because you have nothing else.
Yeah, and I thought that was a really great
And he's the
way.
Only one that stayed after Giant Size X-Men. Everybody else after Giant Size X-Men went, oh, there's new X-Men? All right, I'm going to go join the Champions and the Avengers.
Out.
I'm going to be nothing for a few years until Marvel remembers who
I'm gonna
I am.
I'm going to be one of Spider-Man's amazing friends.
And Cyclops is like, even in the original Cockrum issues, like, Jean Grey is like, all right, we're together and you can be with the X-Men, but I'm going to go get an apartment. And he's like, okay.
Yeah.
Like before she's Phoenix, he does not leave.
There's nothing really beyond the X-Men for Cyclops. It's, you know, since ever he got recruited, you know, the first X-Men, 16 years old or whatever he was, he hasn't, you know, he's had other girlfriends and stuff like this, but it's like, you know, Angel went out and did all this other stuff. There's a lot more going on with that character. Iceman did all this other stuff, went out and did all
Beast is a huge Marvel Universe character.
Well, yeah. I think he's one of the most, like, loved Marvel characters.
Yeah.
Just being on the Avengers, everyone, him and Wonder Man, anytime. Like, I always feel like anytime Beast shows up, they're always like, Henry,
Beast is probably like he's probably the most likable guy, like, in the Marvel Universe.
He's the Stephen Brown of the Marvel Universe.
I don't know that I'd go that far.
Maybe
but
I think he's closer to the Dave Navarro's.
But I think it's the Marvel Universe. Like, you know, everyone,
look at you.
He's been on all the X-Men teams. He's taught at the school. He's intelligent. He's, you know, he's a member of the Illuminati. He was a classic Avenger for many years. It's like, he's the kind of guy.
He's been a dog. He's been a cat. He's been
a
big, dumb guy.
Gorilla.
He's been a Wolverine in blue.
But it's like, everyone's met Beast. He's a pleasant guy. I think he's just like, he's like the everyman of the Marvel Universe. It's like, everyone's had to team up with Beast. Everyone likes him. He's kind of like everyone's favorite
person.
He's
probably the best character in the 90s animated series.
Yeah.
He's probably the most real. He's the only one
that's screaming.
The
dialogue he has with Magneto, where it's just like, I'm here to bust you out. And it's just like, I prefer to go through the legal,
it's like,
justice.
What are you waiting for? My day in court, actually.
Yeah. We just, that's in the Juggernaut episode too, because they break Colossus out.
Yeah.
And Beast is like, oh, hello.
Yeah.
And they're like, we'll break you out too. He's like, nah.
He's just
upside down reading a book.
Doesn't he bend the bars and then bends them back?
Yeah.
It's just like,
yeah, he like lets Colossus go.
And you know what? We haven't touched the movies at all, but the only brilliant thing about X-Men 3 was casting Kelsey Grammer as the Beast.
Yeah.
It was as perfect as casting Patrick Stewart in that first X-Men. It was, here's a guy who is that persona to millions of people, and now you've just put the perfect wrapping paper around the perfect present.
You know what's funny is the more I think about it, I don't think I like any of the X-Men movie, with the exception of maybe like the second Wolverine.
I liked First Class. The other X-Men's, I liked X-Men 2 as like, oh, this is good, and then they made better superhero movies.
I like X-Men 2, and I like the Wolverine, the second Wolverine.
Yeah.
I agree with John.
It's
can't
just like
that.
Every single X-Men movie, with the exception of the First Class, is like, this is the Wolverine movie.
Yeah,
Wolverine's
I think
Wolverine's
the
this.
Big
and
problem.
It's just like, and like.
And then when they gave him his own movie, it was the worst one of all.
Yeah.
Of them.
Yeah. But that's like, I think why I liked First Class so much, because it was the first X-Men movie that felt like
an X-Men movie.
Yes.
Yeah, but my problem with First Class is it was starring no characters I cared about.
Yeah,
it was Banshee and Havoc, and I swear to God, three characters I had never heard of, and I had to Wikipedia them. No, but I read all of New X-Men, like the Butterfly Girl, but like Darwin I'd never heard
Darwin
of.
Darwin was Brubaker during...
Azazel I had never heard of. Like, I had to leave the movie and Wikipedia them and go, oh, they weren't here, because as we started this podcast saying, the X-Men universe is so big, and there's so much stuff out there, and everybody's trying to create their own characters. There's people that are just lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
That's my own. I think X-Men First Class is a great movie. I don't think it would have been better if it starred Cyclops, Wolverine, Nightcrawler, and Colossus, but I really would have cared more.
Yeah, I just
Or if it would have been the five Kirby X-Men.
That's kind of what I was saying, is I would kind of always want that classic, like, you know, they jump so much for Wolverine all the time, and it's just like, you know, even on Claremont's initial run, Wolverine wasn't the main character. It wasn't until much later, you know, Wolverine
wasn't until that limited series.
Yeah,
it was for a long time. Wolverine was on the main character. You look.
Oh,
at
he was
those,
the one dimensional palooka.
Even when he was in the yellow and brown costume. Whenever he was in the yellow and brown costume, you always see him on the cover of the book. He would always be off to the side. It was always Cyclops in the lead,
and he used to be short.
Right, and that's the thing, you know, he used to just be this character, you know, he was like the X-Men's tank, where it's like, the only reason Wolverine was really on the team anyway was because he was too dangerous not to be. It's like, well, you know, we met this Canadian secret agent assassin guy who's a mutant, we could really, you know, he might kill us in our sleep, but if we don't put him on the X-Men, he might join the Brotherhood.
And that was kind of the point of Sabretooth, is like, here's Wolverine not on the X-Men.
Yes.
Right, here's what happens when it goes wrong.
Yeah, this is what he's going to be.
And I think that works a lot better.
I love how Wolverine is anti-Canadian. He is not friendly.
Yeah.
Well, going back to the movies, I think the movies succeed or fail to the extent that they remember that the X-Men is a character-driven and relationship-driven ensemble picture that only marginally lends itself to being a super action blockbuster. Days of Future Past was, I thought, was really good and one of the better ones, not necessarily my favorite, but one of the better ones because it did deal more with some of the relationships as opposed to just set action scene, set action scene, set action scene.
Yeah, and that's what that first X-Men movie is about, is it's about the relationships to the point where I don't like it so much because the third act is a little underwhelming.
Yeah,
it's
because just
like,
the balance
it's just
is
a
off.
Fight on the head of the Statue of Liberty with a team of four and like three villains. It's,
yeah,
it's too small to be an X-Men
like,
story.
And maybe I feel that maybe special effects weren't up to date to tell that story.
I think it didn't have the budget. That's a medium budget movie.
Yeah.
And then like, when it made a lot of money, then it was like, oh, we can put a big team in it and we can have a bigger story.
But how about this, okay? Like, this is one of my biggest things that bugs me about Days of Future Past, the movie. It's just like, we get Sentinels, and we get cool future Sentinels. And I'm like, oh my God, the X-Men are going to fight Sentinels. What happens to the Sentinels? Magneto switches wires using magnetic power and takes control of them. I never saw a scene where he, like, puts in a computer and starts typing in code. It's just like,
all
I'm going to switch.
He pulled some cables out of the train.
Yeah.
And then shoved them in the Sentinels, and that switched them from pro-mutant to anti-mutant.
Yes.
And then it's just like, the X-Men don't really even fight those Sentinels. All they do is they show up, they shoot a bunch of stuff, and then the one guy who
they drop a baseball stadium around the lighthouse.
I thought that was pretty
nice. I think I argued with you in the theater about that. I'm like, what's that about? You're like, because it's awesome.
It's the exact kind of shit. If I was Magneto, that's what I would do.
But then
you can still get out. Baseball stadiums have hundreds of exits.
Sure, but it's going to take you a lot longer to get out of there than it would to just run away.
By that point, I could drop a traveling circus train around them.
But that's what I'm saying. I would keep doing it. I would keep dropping crazier shit on you.
Just Walmarts and 7-Elevens.
Yeah, right?
Cement mixers.
Chuck E. Cheese.
And it's just like that happens, and the one mutant that you want to see really tear up Sentinels, he like wraps up with metal, and he just throws him out in the ocean, and you're just like, okay.
Yeah.
Xavier and Beast going to do against
Sentinels?
That
ending is also the most confusing, where you have Stryker fish him out. And you're like, oh, now we're leading into Weapon X. But then he turns into Mystique. And then you're like, well, now I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's like they throw us a curveball just to do it.
That's like X-Men 3, which ends with both Professor X and Professor X dying and Magneto losing his powers. But then if you watch the intro scene, Professor X comes back to life and Magneto gets his powers back. And it's like, then what's the point?
And that's why I just don't like any of those X-Men movies.
Yeah,
it's one of those
where it's like, I remember
none of them are great.
We live in the world where like Winter Soldier is now like a top quality Marvel comic book movie, and Iron Man and the Avengers. And
Spider-Man 2.
Yeah,
Spider-Man 2 really nails what Spider-Man is, and the other movies not as successfully.
We're talking about the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man 2?
Yes.
Okay, good.
No, we're not talking about that.
No, not amazing.
But it's just like we have that level of storytelling in comic books, and it's just like,
I think if Joss Whedon had made Days of Future Past, you know, obviously it would have probably been a better movie, but I think we actually would have gotten, you know, like the X-Men versus Sentinels, because, you know, you don't really even get it in the future story. In the future story, it's like, oh, here's the X-Men hopelessly outmatched by Sentinels and just getting the tar beaten
which
out
don't
of them.
Really resemble the Sentinels we know at all.
No.
Right? Like, they're all Nimrod, basically.
Exactly.
And it doesn't explain why the Sentinels... It's like, we have DNA sample, a biological sample from a mutant that will somehow transcend into cyber intelligence. And it's just like, I don't get it.
Well, they figured out a way to mechanize Mystique's powers and give them to Sentinels. I can go with that, but...
Yeah, but I think it's something where it's just like, you know, you never really get that classic...
And the time
you know,
travel
the Sentinels, I think,
it.
Are such an iconic, like, villain for the X-Men, which I'll blame also on the 90s cartoon, because it's like all they fought was those fucking Sentinels. You know, they don't show up in the comics that much.
Remember?
Right.
Yeah. There was a video
actually,
game.
In the comics, they are pretty big in the 80s. But they're
usually used by somebody else. There's usually not a Sentinel story.
That's the point.
It's usually somebody like Onslaught or Bastion in Uprising Zero Time. It's like, I have control of Sentinels now, and now that's basically
like they
your
really,
army.
In, really use them
at
well.
The end of Busiek's run on the Avengers, they fight Kang, and the government says to the Avengers, like, all right, well, we need more firepower. We're going to fire up the Sentinel program. And they send like 180 Sentinels to go fight Kang. And it's just like, you know, they're a great villain. And I think
they're a great weapon.
Yeah,
yeah, they're
perfect.
A tool.
It's actually
they're
perfect for the 80s too, because we were dealing with, you know,
nuclear bombs
and like the arms race. Sentinels are on the forefront of that. And I think it was Brubaker Fraction did a run where The X-Men find out that, you know, Saudi Arabia or somebody had gotten a hold of, like, a Sentinel.
Yeah.
And was, like, turning it on and stuff like this.
I think it was Jason Aaron's.
Oh, there. Maybe it was Jason Aaron.
Yeah, and where it's just, like.
But it's, like, two or three issues.
People were buying Sentinels off the black market.
Yeah.
And Quentin Quire was like, see, this is going to happen. Like, the Sentinels are going to, if the U.S. built the Sentinels and now they're selling them to other nations.
Yeah.
And you know these Sentinels are going to turn on
us. I haven't read that, but that sounds like what Fraction was started doing on Iron Man, so I wouldn't be surprised if that was him.
Yeah.
Because it was all about people selling Stark Tech on the black market.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that makes for a really good story. You know, you think we spend so much time in the news talking about, oh, Iran's going to get the nuclear bomb. Iran's going to get a nuclear bomb. And it's like, well, what if Iran got a Sentinel? Now, obviously, that's not going to concern, you know, America as far as, like, they're not going to attack us with a Sentinel. Like, you know, Thor or any extra mutant can knock it out.
If that Sentinel goes but weak, if it goes out of control.
Well, not only that, but say that Iran just turns it on their mutant population. Right now it's like, all right, do the X-Men intervene in that? And it's just like, do they have a right? And I think that those kinds of stories
are interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, they got, I mean, especially with drones in the news. That was one of the things that disappointed me about the RoboCop remake, was they started to touch on that. And it's not a movie we're seeing, if you haven't seen it, it's terrible. But they start to touch on, like, the early versions of RoboCop, basically the version of the ED 209 in the remake is being sent into Iraq and like a drone.
Yeah.
But they don't follow that up with any kind of soundtrack. Don't mean to cut you guys off, but we're at the hour. So for the last question I want to ask, because we can go on about this forever, this turned into an X-Men podcast every week.
Yeah.
The next big thing we have coming, we don't know who the new creative teams are going to be before Bendis leaves, so we don't know what the comic's going to be.
Okay.
But we do know that we're getting an X-Men Apocalypse movie in 2016. We know that Oscar Isaac is playing Apocalypse. We know that Bryan Singer is directing it. We know it takes place in the 80s. Hugh Jackman is in it, but... Ugh. But everyone else is going to be recast. You know, Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy will be playing Professor X and Magneto. How are you feeling about this? Coming off Days of Future Past, coming off a franchise that has been wobbly, how are you feeling about the next movie?
I don't know what to expect. It could go either way. I mean, every other X-Men movie has been, you know, it's like Star Trek. Every other one's pretty good.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Dave?
What I'm hoping for, they're reintroducing Jean Grey, Storm, Cyclops. I really hope they work on an ensemble. Stop with, like, Wolverine taking the lead. Work with an ensemble. You have a well-established Xavier. You have a well-established Magneto. Start building up a decent Brotherhood of Mutants. Start building up a great X-Men team. And have, like, you have an amazing threat. Apocalypse is one of my favorite villains. He's like a villain throughout all time. And it's just like, you have a great threat. Now make a great team to come up to the threat. Don't fall short. And that's honestly a problem that I keep seeing in every X-Men movie, where it's just like, the trailers look amazing, and then the third act comes out and we just bomb.
Yeah, I think I was on board with it until you said Hugh Jackman was in it, because then it's just going to be
Wolverine in the
or
movie.
Whatever it is, because it's, you know, there, you don't, Wolverine, here's the thing, you don't need him in the movie. He's in the movie to get people to go see the movies, but the story doesn't need a Wolverine, because you have Xavier giving the Martin Luther King version of mutant rights, and then you have Magneto giving, like, the Malcolm X version of, like, mutant rights, right? So it's like both sides of the argument, and you, if it's done well, you should be able to see both sides of that argument. Magneto shouldn't be painted as, like, this cackling, like, terrorist. It's not what he is. He's a very complex character. Wolverine just kind of, like, he's just another guy in the way. You know, it's like, that we have to devote time to. I would much rather see, like Dave said, the ensemble cast of mutants, you know, a group following Magneto's ideology and a group following Xavier's ideology, and then here's Apocalypse with these four horsemen, and he's completely batshit crazy. And if the movie opens with the Brotherhood battling the X-Men, a couple skirmishes over a missile base or something, and then they have to team up to fight Apocalypse, that could be great. But I think it's just going to be good, the Wolverine show again. It's like, I've seen that movie half a dozen times. It doesn't work.
Right. I agree. If they could tone down Hugh Jackman's part, which shouldn't be that hard considering Hugh Jackman has had two of his own solo movies. We're getting a third solo Wolverine movie. So it's like, that's the point where just focus on him.
Yeah.
Let him be part of the team. I've always liked Hugh Jackman's Wolverine, and he's gotten to that point like Robert Downey Jr. where he's saying, look, I'm getting old. I don't know how long I'm going to do this. Eventually somebody else is going to be Wolverine. So take that step back that Robert Downey Jr. took in Avengers. He didn't. My worry with Avengers before it came out, that was that Downey was going to dominate.
I had the exact same
because
fear.
Iron Man made so much more money than Cap or Thor. And that didn't happen. It would be great if that didn't happen in Apocalypse. I'm mostly curious about Apocalypse himself. I think Oscar Isaac is a really interesting actor.
What movies are he in?
Inside Llewellyn Davis, the last Coen Brothers film, was really interesting. And he's not a huge guy. He's going to be in Star Wars, but we know nothing about who anyone is in Star Wars, so we don't know what kind of part he's playing. But Apocalypse also visually is the least human mutant. Like, he's been depicted as 20 feet tall. He's always had this giant armor. He's got lips that connect to his ears somehow. He's, like, gray.
Yeah.
I don't know how a human being will play him other than motion capture. And we know from that teaser scene at the end of Days of Future Past, he's not going to be motion capture. So I'm really curious on seeing how they do him.
Yeah, that's just a teaser. And that was, like, you're always curious to see what they'll do, but... Guys, I miss just having one big villain and a bunch of superheroes trying to fight him. Like, I miss that so much. Like, I just want to see a thing where it's just like, there he is, take him out. And the four horsemen come in. They beat the four horsemen. It's like everyone in Apocalypse. And you just see Apocalypse turn and just grow 20 feet in the air and just start smashing all the mutants
away. But I think
away.
That's the thing is we won't get the 20 foot, you know, Apocalypse, who the matter manipulation, whatever he does, we can grow and turn his arms into weapons or whatever. It's like, we're going to get an Apocalypse who's probably got, like, really ambiguous powers, maybe some energy blast or something. It's going to be like...
baseball stadium falls down somehow.
Yeah, like that.
The trouble with the one big villain is, if you do it wrong, you get Transformers Unforgiven.
Yes, and I think that's kind of... I think this definitely has the potential. You know, we saw Days of Future Past kind of... teeter on the edge where it's like, any minute this could go south. I think the Apocalypse movie is going to be, here's the movie where it goes south. Like,
see, that, yeah, I'm so, that's why I'm so excited about Avengers 2, because what, Ultron's like, what, 12 feet tall?
I don't know.
He's like, it doesn't start out that way. But I think the problem, we know we're not going to get more than one villain because Magneto's always got to be in these things, and I don't know why we haven't had a movie other than Wolverine that hasn't had Magneto in it.
Yeah.
He's an interesting character. He's the, you know, you could say he's the Dr. Doom of the X-Men, but there are plenty of X-Men stories where Magneto is nowhere near it.
He's out of the book for years at a time.
And they're unwilling to make a movie without him, so he's always going to be complicating the story.
Let me ask one quick question. What do you guys want to see in the X-Men comic books now that a new creative team is going to take over?
now that Xavier's back...
Is he back?
Yeah, he's back.
The Black Vortex brought him back?
No. What's her name from the all new X-Men brought it? No, from Uncanny X-Men
that
brought
chick,
him back. She went back in time and got him because everything's all screwed up now. I want to see him.
Like, I
know.
Him amazing,
well, but
how's he gonna interact with? It's like, that's my past self.
Because it's his
Bendis.
Past self. Exactly. I want all of this crazy ass timey wimey shit to like get resolved and like don't go back there again for 10 years.
Yeah, I want the X Men to find every time machine in the Marvel universe and smash it with a hammer. I think getting back to basics, getting Bendis far away from that book, getting one team again instead of 400 X Men teams around. Simplify. Stop time travel. Stop changing the Beast into a gorilla. Fucking pick a look and go with this. Goddamn ridiculous with this shit.
What about you? What would make you read the X Men books again?
That's what I would want. I would want something that makes me read the X Men books again. And I think I agree. I think it's simplification because the times I have come back to it. In the last 15 years has been, this is the one book I need to read. Grant Morrison is writing new X-Men and it's not spinning off into a million titles. Then I will read that book. Joss Whedon is writing the X-Men and it's this team and it's this one story. Yeah, I'll read it. X-Men has the potential to suck up your whole life. I was just complaining before the show about how I'm reading too many Batman titles. And when I pick up an issue that's resolving a cliffhanger, I can't remember which cliffhanger it was because I left Batman with five different cliffhangers every month.
Yeah.
And X-Men was even worse than that, to the point where issues wouldn't even be whole stories anymore. They would be like, let's check in on every one of our five subplots and put asterisks about all the other books and then move on. And there were years I felt like I wasn't even reading stories anymore. Yeah. I was just getting Twitter updates for mutants in a book.
And it's something too with the X-Men books. We've joked at the store, there's DC Comics, there's Marvel Comics, and then there's X-Men Comics. There's enough material for X-Men to be its own company, and it widely separates itself from the main Marvel universe for the most part. For a lot of its history.
Which is why it's okay that Fox has it.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, like, I really want Xavier to just, like, if Xavier is back, to give regular, normal adult Cyclops an amazing pep talk, and then have that chick bring Xavier back in the past, bring the young X-Men back in the past, and just be like, Cyclops would be like, all right, well, I'm going to stop being an asshole, and I'm going to start being a leader again, and just meets up with people and just fucking fix everything and let the X-Men be the X-Men again instead of this crazy banana shit going on left and right.
All right. Well, we could keep going forever, but this is a long one for us already. So as always, you can follow me and Out of My Book on Twitter. That is the official Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Facebook is going great guns. We have teasers of upcoming episodes on there now. Trying to get more of a dialogue. Love it when people comment. So if you are checking in on our page, we've had a few of our posts go viral. Feel free to leave a comment and feel free to like it and come back to us. Leave us a review on iTunes if you've been listening a long time. We've gotten a few. Every now and then I check and there's some new reviews. And they've always been positive. So I assume if you're listening to this week after week, you have positive reviews for us.
We'll take negative ones.
I'll take a negative review. Tell me what we're doing wrong.
All right, you want a negative one, Steven Brown? I'll give you a negative right after the show.
Well, Dave, how do we follow you?
Dave Redfield at social media things. Yes, Dave Redfield.
So Facebook, Twitter and
Twitter,
Facebook.
All that nonsense.
Joe?
I am at Zen Master Guy, all one together as one word, on Twitter.
And I am at 19 South of Grange Road.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that, meatball!